Okay. Yeah, I'd like to thank the organizers. And as Thierry mentioned, he gave a nice introduction to the situation with the sterile neutrinos. And so I'll try to just cover a couple key topics in there to flesh out these questions. But briefly, I'll start with a single introduction slide. You know, why sterile neutrinos? So yes, we do have some experimental motivations that have kind of guided us to look at these questions from these questions of reactor antineutrinos and the discrepancies with measurements of intense radioactive sources, as well as the LSND phenomenon of excess appearance of nu E and nu mu beams. Now, at the same time, we do also have theoretical motivation. Every time I go to my theorist friends and ask them, you know, should we really expect sterile neutrinos? They seem to have this bias that, oh yes, sterile neutrinos should exist and there should be lots of them. I don't know. motivated by, you know, the Majorana neutrino mass that you could imply some heavy neutrino states. Beyond the standard model, it seems that you add extensions and the next thing you know, you get these neutral, sterile-like neutrino states appearing, as well as cosmology as potential candidates for dark matter. One thing I should highlight here, though, is that most of the experimental motivation has been on the EV scale, whereas the theoretical motivation, I think that's kind of a more open field. And so we might want to keep our mind kind of broad when we look at searches for sterile neutrinos. Okay, so my talk today, I'll really just focus on three kind of aspects. First, what I call the trouble with absolute measurements. And I'll go into that, specifically the reactor antineutrino anomaly. And then I'll say a little bit about the strength of relative measurements, what we've seen just this past year in some very impressive measurements to try to put limits on sterile neutrinos. And then I'll have a brief comment looking forward. Okay, so the trouble with absolute measurements. So for reactor antineutrinos, in principle, the physics we understand, how they're produced inside the reactor. You have actinides, mainly uranium and plutonium. These fission produce neutron-rich daughter fragments. So here is a distribution of these of the predicted yields of isotopes in a fission reactor. And so you can see you tend to get two kind of clusters in this mass space of neutron versus proton number. These are neutron rich. On average, they need to undergo 6 beta decays until they reach stability. Now, in these beta decays, of course, of these fission daughters, you emit, of course, electrons and antineutrinos. Now, if we look at our expectations about the reactor, we have something of the order of more than 1,000 known fission daughter fragments. And then adding in that each of these daughter fragments could decay to a variety of possible states in the decay, you have something on the order of about 10K unique decays that are taking place in a reactor at any time. And here's an example spectra of the neutrinos emitted from one of the prominent fission daughters, 97 yttrium. And we, in our nuclear databases, we have 9 known decays, and you can see that it's combined to give you this rather interesting spectral shape. But in principle, the physics is well understood. You know, if we had a concrete understanding of the fission yields, a concrete understanding of their decays, we could add that together and calculate the total neutrino spectra. Now, the question is, what actual data do we have to address this problem? And our data comes in 3 flavors. We have actual measurements of the antineutrino spectra from reactors. Here we don't, I should be clear here, we tend to show these spectra as antineutrino spectra, but what we're really measuring are the outgoing positrons from inverse beta decay on hydrogen by these neutrinos. Now fortunately, those positrons are a very clear marker of the incoming neutrino energy. It, minus some recoil of the nucleus, we're talking tens of keV, these are fairly well correlated to the incoming neutrino energy. The other piece of the puzzle we have are fission electron measurements. Back in the 1980s, a series of measurements by using the Bill spectrometer at ILL measured the outgoing electrons from fission of U-235, plutonium-241, 239. And in principle, you know, through kinematics, we should know the outgoing electron spectra should be highly correlated to the outgoing neutrino spectra. And then our last player are just our sum total knowledge of measured fission and nuclear decay from the past century of nuclear measurements that we can use to bring to bear on this problem. Okay, so I'll start with the first character here. Right now, we have recent experiments that have reached phenomenal statistics in antineutrino measurements. Both Reno, Doubleshow, Dia Bay, they're at the level of millions of antineutrino detections. This is kind of a new experience for me. I started off in Camland, where we were struggling to measure one neutrino a day, and to now see that we're detecting such high statistics for such a weakly interacting particle, I find astounding. And these latest measurements are extremely low background, percent level background. So we have high purity, very clear neutrino measurements. And so this is kind of pushing the envelope on our understanding. When we're making these very precise measurements, the models that we use to try to compare them to need to achieve similar levels of precision. So here are the latest measurements we've seen from the three experiments, Dia Bay, where we have just over a million, Reno here, and Doubleshow spectra as well. Okay, and they all seem to present a very consistent spectral measurement. So I think we have confidence that we are accurately measuring the antineutrino spectra. Now, the electron spectra, these were measurements, as I mentioned, done at ILL in the 1980s. These are also some very impressive measurements. So here you have the housing for the ILL reactor. Inside, they placed samples of actinides, uranium and plutonium, expose them to the thermal neutron flux, and then use this spectrometer to guide out the electrons and to measure their spectra accurately over six orders of magnitude. You can see here from low energies around 1 to 2 MeV up to 10 MeV, you can see this steeply falling spectra, which is just the sum total of all these fission, you know, the fission daughters decaying and emitting electrons. Okay, so in principle, our understanding of the kinematics of beta decay should give us a very strong correlation between these two sets of measurements. We have the electrons and the antineutrinos, and there's a whole body of work that sits behind trying to relate these two. Now, there's some subtle differences in that nuclear corrections add some slight deviations from electrons relative to antineutrinos. So you have things like the Coulomb correction impacts these two in an opposite fashion. Weak magnetism, finite size of the nucleus, and screening and radiative corrections. But I like these set of figures here prepared by Patrick Huber, which shows the characteristics of these corrections that are being made when you're comparing. For example, if you picked an arbitrary fission daughter with the charge of 46 and an endpoint of 10 MeV, these are the size of these corrections you'd be applying to their beta decay spectra, and it's introducing, you know, five-ish percent asymmetries between the electron and antineutrino. But you can try to account for this very carefully, and from this, we've seen an even more extended approach recently, where Muller et al. They actually incorporated as much as they could of known nuclear data to try to pin down all of these nuclear corrections in this conversion. The initial Vogel and Huber approach just used statistical models, knowing what we know about them. But here, Mueller, they actually implemented the known corrections for as many of the fission daughters and decays that were tabulated taking place in the reactor. Now, this model in particular, it predicts a neutrino rate and spectrum with on the order of 3% precision. That's the level of uncertainties you introduce in trying to correlate these two. And this is where we find both a rate discrepancy, which Thierry spoke about, which is considered possible evidence for sterile neutrinos. And more recently, we've seen spectral discrepancies. So here's the ratio of the observed antineutrino spectra in the Reno, Doubleshow, and Diabe experiment relative to these predictions you get based on these old electron measurements. So if you do this conversion of the electrons to, and you can see that they show in particular this distinct feature. All three of the experiments show this very distinct feature between 4 to 6 in prompt energy that, given the offset from the inverse beta decay, this is actually 5 to 7 MeV in antineutrino energy. Okay. Now the question is, what could be causing this discrepancy in this data? Hayes, I think, Anna Hayes and company have, I think, written the most recent summary of our understanding of this problem. They looked at a few candidate explanations for the discrepancies. That there was some non-fission source of antineutrinos, for example, neutron capture on reactor materials that would, you know, produce unstable isotopes that would decay emitting antineutrinos. But both they and you can look in the literature going back 30 years, the calculations on this all predict corrections sub-percent level. So it doesn't seem to be sufficient to explain the bump. Forbidden nature of some beta decay transitions. In these relationships between the electron spectra and antineutrino spectra, we tried to consider, well, those so far had considered only allowed shapes. What if you start to account for potential forbidden shape corrections? Here also, you can play around with this, but while you can distort you can distort the electron spectra and antineutrino spectra with forbidden corrections, it's hard to introduce distortions that deviate, you know, that introduce a systematic bias between the two, in particular introducing something like a bump. So if you play around with these with the data, you can introduce all kinds of forbidden corrections, but at most you introduce also percent level deviations between the two between the electron and antineutrino spectra. An additional question is U-238 fission. The original ILL measurements of the electrons had only measured U-235 and plutonium, and the plutoniums had not measured U-238 because this is a little more challenging. You need fast neutron fission. But even here, U-238 is actually a small fraction of the total fission budget of a reactor, and so you'd have to have fairly astounding deviations in the U-238 fission to introduce such a large effect as what's seen in the recent generation of experiments. So they mark this as, well, we can maybe explain up to about a quarter of this spectral deviation at high energies as U-238, but it doesn't seem to be capable of explaining the full discrepancy. And they identify two candidates, and I would agree with them here, that the relatively harder neutron spectrum in a pressurized water reactor, this could lead to a slight different distribution of fission daughters compared to what was achieved in the ILL measurement, where they're using thermal neutron fission. So this, you could think, this would take, you know, we'd have to understand very well the exact impact of some fast neutron fission as well as epithermal fission in a commercial reactor, and I don't think we have that level of precision right now. So this could be an explanation. Another possible error is that maybe there was just some error in these the ILL electron measurements. This is a single set of measurements done in the 1980s. We have no cross-check. Of course, it is a very difficult measurement to do. So, okay. So I came into this game seeing this discrepancy worrying very much how this might impact the Diabe oscillation measurement, which was my day job. And so even I tried to ask the question, well, what can these fission to nuclear decay databases, the sum total of all the knowledge of our modeling of nuclear reactors, tell us? Can it guide us anywhere in these questions? And this is a long field. You see calculations of this going back to, you know, Vogel has a series of calculations, as well as some more recent work by Fallot, Sonzoni, and Anna as well. But there's real problems with just trying to directly, you know, calculate the exact emission from the reactor. These nuclear databases have a lot of missing details. We don't have fission yields and comprehensive decay data. Are there systematic biases in these nuclear databases? There's discussions for specifically about questions such as the pandemonium effect. Are we losing high energy beta decay branches just because of the technique we use to measure many of these, the nuclear structure of many of these isotopes? And then this also question about beta decay shape corrections. How might forbidden corrections impact the spectra? So there's a lot of these questions that come up when you start to do these calculations, and you quickly find that it's difficult to have much more than a 10% level confidence in outgoing calculations of either the antineutrinos or the electrons from these calculations. But one thing that surprised me quite extensively when I looked into this is that a relatively small number of branches dominate the antineutrino emission between 5 to 7 MeV. It turns out that 5 ground state to ground state transitions seem to contribute roughly half of the predicted antineutrinos coming from the reactor. So here I draw their beta decay spectra, the emitted antineutrino spectra, weighed by the inverse beta decay cross-section. And the uncertainties here are just shown the uncertainties in their fission yield and branching ratio from the existing nuclear data tables. You can see that there are some significant uncertainties here. For example, rubidium-92 looks fairly poor constrained. But if you look at how these add up in the total calculation of the spectra, they produce what seems to be a very similar shoulder as what we see in the antineutrino measurements, right in the 5 to 7 MeV region. And I find that if this nuclear data is accurate, this shoulder seems to be a robust conclusion of these calculations. So my question was then, are these fission yields and branching fractions for these 8 transitions actually correct? Well, there are a lot of issues there. If you look, there's a nice paper by Sanzoni recently where he's been looking into the nuclear data tables, and they find just some rather gross errors in the data tables. If you look at thermal fission yields of Z equals 32, at the high end, they have fission yields that are clearly off by orders of magnitude relative to expectation. And it looks like it was just a transcription error when they were writing the database. Yeah. There's a lot of missing decays. Of the estimated something of 10,000 decays that you'd predict to be contributing to the total spectra, roughly 70% of those we have no decay data for. Fortunately, while that's a rather large fraction of the calculation, they only amount to about 5% of what's going on in the reactor. Those isotopes which have high fission yields, we tend to also have very good decay data for. So in that sense, it's a smaller subset that amounts to a large fraction of the total decay. But here you can see Anna Hayes and company have shown what they estimate for. They use some statistical models to try to account for these missing decays, and you can see roughly the contribution to the total spectra there. So it's a small, relatively smooth contribution. The next issue is just inconsistency. Each region seems to maintain its own nuclear database. We have, you know, NDEF in the US, we have JEF in Europe. If you look at calculations with NDEF, that's the red figure here, that shows a similar shoulder at high energy in this as what we see in the Diabay data, the black. So Anna repeated the calculation that I had done, and she sees, oh yeah, it seems to predict this bump. But then our European colleagues were saying, we don't see the same thing. Now, if you use the European fission databases, they don't They don't see that. This seems to be traced down to issues in claims of fission yields. The European databases predict a very different fission yields relative to the NDEF databases. Outside their claimed level of uncertainties. That's, I think, is just as important of an issue. Just this past year, we've seen some very good measurements of three of the most prominent fission daughters contributing in this 5 to 7 MeV region. Using total absorption spectrometry, both at Oak Ridge as well as Igasol. And this has introduced some very significant changes to nuclear structure in the NSDEF database, both for cesium-142 and rubidium-92. Once again, these changes seem to be outside the claimed uncertainties in the nuclear structure databases. Okay, so that brings me to a summary of the first part of my talk. What we see is that when trying to correlate the antineutrino and electron measurements, the rate disagrees, the spectra disagrees, and this has been kind of motivation for the searches for sterile neutrinos here. Could there be some systematic or experimental explanation for this? I think fission neutron energy and problems with these electron measurements are potential candidates. And the question is, what can nuclear data bring to bear on this? I think tackling trying to do direct comparisons of the rate, from nuclear databases is very difficult. But the spectra, I think, has some potential because it's a smaller number of very prominent isotopes seem to dominate the actual shape of the spectra. Okay, so that brings me to part two of the talk. The last section I complained about absolute measurements. Now I'll say we've seen some very nice relative measurements this past year that have brought some constraints onto sterile neutrinos. First is the Dive A experiment. This experiment is measured at theta-1-3, one of the actual three flavor known mixing angles, by placing a set of antineutrino detectors close to a set of six reactors in southern China, and then an additional set of detectors at roughly 2 kilometers. And by comparing both the rate and spectra measured at these near detectors versus the far detectors, it was able to measure theta-1-3 with 3-4% precision. Now, you could play the same game and say, well, what if we introduce a sterile neutrino into this mix? How might it distort not only the spectra measured at the near sites versus near detectors versus far detectors, but the near detectors versus each other because they sit at slightly different distances? And you can do these calculations and look at the ratio of our neutrinos detected in these sets of detectors relative to our experimental Hall 1. And the black dots show the ratio of those two spectra. And then overlaid are a couple lines showing how we might expect the spectral ratio to be distorted by the presence of an additional sterile neutrino with the mass differences shown here. And 5% mixing. So you can see that this approach of doing these relative spectral measurements is rather strong in constraining potential additions of a sterile neutrino. And from this, we construct confidence intervals. And you can see we're reaching down to the level of 1-ish% precision in ruling out. So everything to the right here is excluded. So we've excluded mixing at the percent level for mass splittings in the 10 to the 1, to 10 to the, down to 10 to the 3 level. So it gives rather strong constraints, maybe not in the preferred region. The region preferred by existing the anomalies, but I think it's still nice to push a constraint into any open parameter space, as we see. Now, we've combined this work with additional measurements by the Minos collaboration, as well as incorporating existing limits from Dive A to try to provide extensive constraint on the LS&D anomaly. And here you can see that combining these three, including both the muon component from Minos, the electron component from Dive and Bouguer. And now we've ruled out most of the mini-boon allowed region down here. There's still some allowed space just above one, a couple eV squared, but it's really started to exclude these potential explanations for the LSMD anomaly. The third experiment we've seen this past year is IceCube. And it's also, you might think, how could IceCube be a relative measurement? But here they exploit a very interesting feature that if a sterile neutrino had EV scale mix, mass splitting, it would suffer from a MSW resonance as it passed through the Earth. And so what you can do is you can compare neutrinos coming straight through the Earth's core versus those atmospheric neutrinos produced on the far side, you know, at other zenith angles on the horizon, and compare the relative spectra that you observe. And here just shows what a sterile neutrino would look like in this space. Of here's neutrino muon neutrino energy versus the zenith angle. So this is those coming from the bottom of the Earth. This is the horizon. So if we look down, you can see that for the most part, it doesn't seem to impact a muon neutrinos. But in the muon antineutrinos, you'd hit this resonance at the Earth's core that would convert roughly 100% of the neutrinos to sterile. Now, of course, they don't, you know, IceCube doesn't have perfect energy and angular resolution. So if you look at what the net effect in the detector would be, is it would look like a 10%-ish level distortion for neutrinos going straight up from the Earth's core at roughly this energy. And so by playing off what they see versus energy and angle, they can actually place rather stringent constraints on sterile mixing. And you can see that here's a theta-2-4 mixing from muon to sterile, mixing in the EV scale range, and they extend this also right in here. So once again, it's getting tough for EV sterile neutrinos. Okay. Now I'll start looking forward, just give you a very brief comment. So there are many experimental routes to further pursue EV steriles. You heard from Thierry, intense radioactive sources, tritium. We haven't mentioned accelerator neutrinos, but there's a very comprehensive program at Fermilab looking at this, as well as short baseline reactors, and there's a number of other methods. And I think George will also talk a little bit about steriles in the future. We have it's relatively inexpensive to field a small-scale reactor neutrino experiment. And so we've seen a proliferation of projects on the table. These are all either in the prototyping or actual deployment stage. And I think I would expect over the next couple of years to see very extensive limits on EV steriles from these reactor experiments. The one challenge here is that it's not so easy to measure reactor antineutrinos when you're 10 meters or less from a reactor. We've seen two experiments that have done this at 25 meter level, and even there they were, you know, 100 backgrounds for every 400 signal. The Nucifer was at 12 meters and it had 300 signal for every 1,000 background. So it's very difficult to achieve this. But there's been some very significant R&D to try to constrain this. And you know, I've looked at this in with respect to the PROSPECT experiment. It's located at the Heifer core at Oak Ridge. It's a few ton scale experiment at a few meters. And then, so it uses a segmented detector. So you look both by measuring both the energy and distance using this segmentation, you'd expect to see a distinct oscillation curve in the distance versus neutrino energy. And from that, you could constrain the EV mixing at the 5% level or so. So I think, and this is just one example. All the others, I think, have very comparable sensitivities on the table. So with that, I'll just stop and summarize. I think stellar neutrinos really have some potential for new physics beyond the standard model. Existing hints, you know, are these real or are they just subtle artifacts of problems with making absolute measurements? We've seen some very good recent progress via relative measurements, kind of pushing LS&D and mini-Boone kind of out of the picture, I think. And then there'll be a broad program that's going to search for stellar neutrinos at the EV scale and even beyond at other mass scales over the coming 5 years or so. Thank you.
Just point out that you know, what really is looked at and the claims for LS&D and mini-Boone, for example, if you look at that horizontal axis, it's really a coherent, you know, new mu to new sterile state to a new E state, and so it's the product essentially of the two mixing matrix elements squared.
Yeah.
But what's relevant for astrophysics is not that. It's of course each individual component in the product. Mm-hmm. So from an astrophysicist standpoint, those mixings are absolutely immense.
Yeah, you're right, yeah, I'd agree.
And though many of the ones we look at actually are interested in, for example, for the R process or cosmology, are you know, many orders of magnitude smaller than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This problem you pointed out with the neutron data, different compilations, it's really a scandal.
Yeah.
And it also affects astrophysics. We're seeing the same thing. Order
of
magnitude changes in critical cross-sections, even when they're using the same set of data.
Yeah.
So it's theory. It's the fits that they're doing to theory points.
Ah, okay, okay.
Well, let me ask on the forbidden decays, has anybody done a serious calculation to try to include the forbidden decays? I mean, most of us up to do the allowed decays when they're calculated.
Yeah. So I've done I haven't done a serious calculation. I should say that I've looked at, if I introduce extreme forbiddenness, like choose all of the decays have one kind of very strange forbiddenness, and yet not look at how that changes the absolute spectra, but how it changes the electron relative to neutrino spectra, you still see the ratio is relatively flat. It still introduces a relatively smooth feature. So in that sense, it's hard for forbiddenness to introduce some deviation between the electron and antineutrino spectra. Although in these summation calculations where you're just trying to start from the nuclear data and from that calculate either the neutrino or antineutrino, there you can introduce pretty significant distortions if you assume the forbiddenness. Now, I'll add a caveat there, that it seems like a smaller number of isotopes or of decays contribute the bulk of the antineutrino emission. These tend to have very high fission yields. They tend to be closer to the valley of stability, so they tend to be isotopes that are more accessible and well-measured. And they tend to be transitions that are not strongly suppressed, because if they're strongly suppressed, then they don't, you know, their beta decay rate is low, you don't see them contribute as much to the antineutrino spectra. So in that sense, the forbiddenness doesn't seem to be, you know, for example, the eight branches that really seem to be in that dominant region, they're all ground state to ground state transitions with, you know, most of them have zero, for, you know, they're not strongly, you know, they just parity violating, they change a parity, but they don't change significantly the angular momentum. So in that sense, you wouldn't expect strong forbidden corrections on those dominant contributors. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, if you put ice cube on top of your left figure, is any region left for LS&D or my
Yeah, I think in general, if you start, I mean, theorists are clever. They always seem to come up with some way that you could construct a multi-sterile model with degenerate states that could somehow evade things. But at least in the simplest regime of just considering mixing to an additional neutrino, an additional sterile in the EV scale, it seems to be very difficult. And I'd also agree with what George said, that if you start to look at these implications for these in the astrophysical setting, you would be shocked if you hadn't seen some impact of those already. So I personally, I'm not a sterile true believer. I think, you know, the existing EV scale evidence is maybe we should take a look at our experiments and the systematics and those things. But at the same time, I think the potential of steriles at some other energy scale, I'm not willing to just rule out that, okay, there are no sterile neutrinos out there, but maybe we should be thinking carefully about where they might be in phase space.
But LSND and mini-boon are sort of out now.
I would be shocked.
Within one or two sterile.
At least that's my feeling of looking at how things stand. I don't see that as being convincing evidence for sterile neutrinos.
Another comment or question for Dan? If not, let's thank him again. We have lunch in the courtyard, and then George, you're on for